Miller. All right, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Leonard from Santa Maria.
Oh, my name's Leonard. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And first of all, I want to recognize all the birthdays. It's like I'm really honored. And when I first got here, I thought, man, all these people came out to see me. What the hell? I'm doing all that. So, but actually, I'm grateful to see that, you know, it's just not about me, because it's always been about me. Always been about me. And I want to welcome the newcomers, Chuck, Savannah,
yes.
Savannah, Kelly, and there was someone else. Is that it?
Paula.
Paula, yeah, where's Paula at? But anyway, I want to welcome you. Yes, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you found here what I have found here. And I can tell you what I have found here, and it's evident in this room right here. So I stand here at this podium, and I stand in a room full of some of the people that I love the most dearly in the entire world, and who in turn love me. And you know what? That was what I was always looking for. You know, I just wanted to fit in. I just wanted to feel like I fit, and I just never felt like I fit, you know. And so let me stop for a minute and ask for some direction. All right. So, you know, I never know what I'm going to say when I get up here. But I do know I'm going to talk a lot of shit, so get ready. And I'm going to cuss, you know, and there's a thing that I'm going to say something that I want to share is that, you know what, the first thing I want to tell you is thank you. You know, the other thing I want to tell you is that I'm sorry. If I've done something to offend you, I'm sorry. And please forgive me. And the third thing, or fourth thing I want to say is I love you. And so that's me coming from my heart and my true self. Regardless of what I show you up front, that's really where I'm coming from, you know? Because I got this layers of shit that I got on top of me that I use to protect me, and it's really hard for me to get past that stuff most of the time. And it takes a conscious effort for me to get past that. And with your help, I'm able to do that. So these two drunks, or this is one drunk, and he walks in the bar, right? And he sits down. No, I'm not going to do the two drunk. I'm going to do the one drunk. All right. So he sits down, and the bartender says, get your ass out here. We do not serve drunks in here. So the guy looks around and goes, oh, man, whatever. And he gets up and he walks out. And a couple of minutes later, he comes in through the side door and comes and sits back down. Give me a drink. And the bartender says, look, I told you, we don't serve drunks in here. So he gets up, walks out, one more time, comes in the back door and sits down. He goes, bartender, give me a drink. And the bartender just lays on him. And then the drunk looks up to him and he says, damn, how many bars do you work in? And the reason why I love that joke is because that's what my life was like. I constantly kept doing the same shit and getting the same response and thought that it was them. It's like, there's got to be something fucking wrong with you, because there's got to be a way that I can get life to do what I wanted to do. And it just wouldn't, you know. And finally, I got to a place where I was willing to let life tell me what it wanted me to do. And it's gotten me here in front of you today. I'm a product of you people. You guys have molded me, chipped off a lot of rough edges, polished up some others. But most importantly, you love me through all of it, all of it. And if you're new, or you're fairly new, and you're sitting in here and you feel a little bit like, I don't know about this shit, well, you're in the right place, you know. And the one thing that I have found that's been the hardest thing that I've ever had to do in my life is to let you love me. You know, that's been the big hurdle in my life. And so let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. You know, just grab onto someone else in here, anybody. For the newcomers, it usually works better if you go downhill, you know what I mean by that? You know, you get a guy who's sicker than you and let him love you. So, you know, it works real good, you know. Or women, find a woman that's a little bit, you know, got a little bit less time to you and let her love you, you know. And because there's a couple of things that I had to learn how to do. And the first thing was to be honest, you know. And I found it's real difficult to be honest with people that I look up to, you know, especially in the beginning. So I learned how to do is to be honest with the people that I didn't give a shit what they thought about me, you know. But it didn't matter. I was getting honest, you know. And there's some tricks in here that work real well. As I started to get a little bit better, I could start to open up a little bit more to more people. But it's a process, and it took time. And it took a lot of time. So I'll tell you a little bit about my story. because you guys want to hear my story. And it's a story, like everyone else, we all have a story. I don't think anyone's any better than any other. I heard a lady last night that shared some things that really brought me back home to where I come from. I grew up a military brat, so I was in the military. And so, you know, for my first 5 years, life was really cool, you know. I was like the only boy in a family of, you know, I had three sisters and a mom and a dad. And my dad was a rageaholic, and he was just a perfectionist, and he was an alcoholic, you know, but he was a functioning alcoholic, a very highly functioning alcoholic. And he scared the shit out of me. You know, he terrified me. As a matter of fact, to the day that he died, I never was able to get to a place where I was able to be honest with him. And it wasn't because he didn't want to hear the truth. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. It's like I was raised to tell my dad what he wanted to hear, you know, and he held grudges. So, you know, I never knew if I said the wrong thing, you know, he'll hate me for the rest of my life, you know. And I was talking about it last night. It was like, you know, him and my mother split up and they never spoke again, you know. That kind of shit, you know, and that's what I grew up with and that's what I knew. So we were in the military and I was the only boy. And so I had that sense of privilege, you know. My dad was, you know, basically, we live in this patriarchal system, and, you know, the women go do that stuff, and I was his son, which was really cool on one level, but the other side of it was real lonely, because I've got this big old house going on, and I'd come along and, you know, want to play, no, then you go in your other room, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I had that sense of being different, and set, you know, apart from the very beginning. But I did learn some coping skills very quickly, and the reason why I learned them is because we moved so much. So I learned how to adapt really quickly. I learned how to figure out what it is that what I needed to do to get you to accept me. You know, I heard a guy say it once. It was kind of like carving these graven images. And what it was is I got really good at carving an image of myself in you. That makes sense. You know, I got real good at figuring out how I could get you to see me the way that I wanted you to see me. Which all that did was just alienate me that much further from myself. And that started at a really young age, But nonetheless, I had a great childhood. You know, we moved around a bunch of different places. And I was a bit of a novelty because, I don't know if that's a good word. But anyway, we would travel. But in the military, everything's blue. Everything's blue. Everyone's on a kind of level playing field, you know. And so here I am, this African-American young man, child. In this sea of blue, and my dad kind of had some rank, he had some authority, he had some status. So I was used to being kind of special or different. You know, people say, oh, a little flip, you know, so I picked that up. I picked this thing up about me that some people would say it's called a sense of entitlement. You know, I got it. I have this sense of entitlement about me. And I don't think I've really lost that. I still have a sense of, you know, this, you know, all the rules don't apply to me. And I've had to work on that. The other thing that I learned how to do is I learned how to, I guess I'll have to say it. You have to tell the truth, huh? I learned how to manipulate women very well. I grew up in a house full of women, and I adore women, you know. But that's how I learned how to survive, because I'm in this room, this house with these bunch of women, and I had to figure out how to get them to, you know, like me and work with me, you know. And so that kind of became a skill that I have, you know, when I like pretty good, actually. You know, but these were things that kind of separated me. I felt separate. I was different. So, you know, so we moved around a lot, and I didn't think it was a big deal. But the problem was I never learned how to create or deep and meaningful relationships. You know, most people know how to go deep. I know how to go wide. You know, and what do I mean by that? Yeah. Okay. That wasn't quite what I had in mind, but I mean, if it works for you, run with it, you know. But yeah, so I had a difficult time getting, you know, developing deep, intimate relationships. I'm really good on the surface, but when you get past that, you know, it's like, it's very uncomfortable for me, and that's still true today, and it's something that I have to work on. I've been here in Santa Maria for 10 years. This is the longest I've ever been in one place in my entire life, you know, and so I'm learning. I'm still growing, you know, and if you're an Alcoholics Anonymous and you've got a past that looks like shit, you're okay because you get a new one. You know, if you're here and you stay here, you get to create a different path. And I'm so grateful for that, because when I got here, mine was a fat wreck. And I'm going to speed up here so I can kind of get through it, because I think it's important. So anyway, we moved to Germany when I was probably about eight or nine. And I couldn't think of something any more wonderful of a childhood for a kid. You know, it's Germany when another world on the other side of the continent. This is when the German dollar thing was like in our favor. So we had a pretty good lifestyle, and my dad had, he was like a master sergeant, whatever. He was like the main guy on our housing thing. So I had this instant respect, even from adults, you know, because I wasn't just Leonard. I was Master Sergeant Leonard's son, you know, and that kind of shit, you know. So it was really cool. And it was just a great childhood, you know. It was really neat, and I did all kind of neat stuff. And did the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts. But the funny thing was is, you know what, I did the Cub Scouts and I got kicked out. Did the Boy Scouts to kick me out of that. And I was like, what's going on here, you know? And I did shit like, you know, caught the woods on fire and, and beat kids up. And I don't know if anyone here can relate to that, but I always thought that I was like other people and I wasn't. Because I was always the one that got caught. I don't know if anybody else can relate to that, but everyone else seemed to get away with shit, I was the one that got caught. And I always just, even back then, I wondered, what's going on with this, you know? And so my parents drank. That's what they did back then. And I know that I was an alcoholic way before I put any alcohol in my system at all. First of all, you know, I was asthmatic as a child, so they were pumping speed in me all the time just to keep me alive. And I didn't, you know, I had never really thought about that. You know, I spent most of my first years in a tent. And I was very fragile as a child. I was very sickly. I'm still very sickly. And I forgot about that too, you know. It's like, I couldn't do the things that other kids did. You know, they would play baseball, and I would have to quit in the middle of the baseball game because I had an asthma attack. I mean, it just was that kind of stuff that just separated me from everyone else. But my first experience with alcohol is my parents were having a party. And I just remember they used to have highballs. They used to have little plastic cups, and they had where they put it in a decanter where you could turn it like this. So, you know, I remember that, and buckets of ice. I just remember all of that. And I was about this big, and I would walk around, and for some reason, it wasn't that I wanted to get drunk, but it just looked cool. So I was walking around. I was supposed to be in bed, actually, and I'm walking around drinking the leftover alcohol in the thing. And then that's the last thing I remember. And the next morning I remember that I was laying in my bed covered in vomit. And my family was standing over me laughing. You know, like, that's what you get. You know, and what I didn't know was that that was an incident that was going to repeat itself over and over and over and over and over again for the rest of my life. I know today that if I put any alcohol in my system, I ain't going to wake up with vomit. I'm going to wake up with something on me that I do not want on me. It's inevitable. And it took me a long time to figure out that it was the alcohol. I did not know that it was the alcohol. Now, strange to say, that wasn't my introduction to, you know, I would say, I'm going to use the word addiction. Now, drugs is a big part of my story. Because I wasn't really all that thrilled about the outcome of that. And I kind of went on with my childhood, but then the big kaboom happened and my parents split up. And so I went through probably what was probably the most profound culture shock that I think any time a child's family gets ripped apart is a profound culture shock. Because it's like you go from one world to another, and to a 10, 11, 12-year-old mind, it doesn't, you try to make sense of it. But you can't, because it's like the world just gets turned upside down. So my father came out here to California, and my mother moved to Atlanta, Georgia, to what they call the projects in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, if you ever watch TV and you see those like New Jack City movies, you know, with all the broken down buildings and shit like that, that's where we moved to. And so here I am, the only boy, trying to become a man at this point. And I got these four sisters and a mother who are struggling. You know, there was days we didn't have food to eat. And I had to adapt really quick. And so it was at that point in my life that I took on a code. And that code was kill or be killed, eat or be eaten, win at all costs, us against them. I took on a code that to this day I have still tried to shed. But I'm grateful for it because it's allowed me to understand people that come from that place. And it's like that. It's like in that environment, the the good are those who thrive. It's like being in the jungle, you know. A lion who's not fierce doesn't survive. So you become, I became that thing, you know. And I lied, I cheated, I stole, I manipulated, I conned, and I internalized it. You know, I internalized it, and I became like those people. And the people that became my peers, my heroes, were pimps and drug dealers and, you know, and con artists and, you know, bank robbers. I remember, you know, my favorite, I'm going to date myself a little bit, but my favorite show in the entire world has always been It Takes a Thief. Anybody know what that show is? I love that fucking guy, you know, because that's what my mentality became. And I was convinced that I could beat the world at some point, you know. The other side was I convinced that the world that worked for other people did not and would not work for me. It literally left my conscience. The idea of living the life that I live today was unthinkable. And so that was my first drug. That was my first drug. And I went at that with the gusto of any 15, 16-year-old could have. And it didn't take long for it to catch up with me. So, and this is when I found that drugs would help. So when I originally started using drugs, it was because it helped me further my criminal intent. I remember the first time I smoked a cigarette, because there was a girl I liked, and she gave me her phone number, and it gave me the courage to pick up the phone and call her. So I always had that idea that drugs were going to give me something from the outside that was going to fix me from the inside. And then I would drink a little bit here and there. And the reason, my mother was a pot smoker, so she smoked pot all the time. But that wasn't my focus. My focus was that criminal intent. But what happened is I got involved in a little half-ass gang there, and we were kicking and breaking people's houses and stuff like that, fearless, stupid fearless. And at this time, I started drinking, and I was a blackout drinker, and I was a very violent drinker. Well, I was a violent person, period, but I was a violent drinker. I was a person that would blackout and do stuff like walk around, slap people, beat people up, throw people out of windows, just that kind of shit. And a lot of it I wouldn't remember. You know, I wouldn't remember. I would come the next day and people would tell me, oh, man, you know what you did? And, you know, you did this and this and this. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, if you say so, you know. And that caught up with me. And some people went to my mother and they said, you know what, you better get your son out of here or we're going to kill him. Simple as that. We want him out of here and we're going to kill him. So she put me on an airplane to sunny California. And I got off that plane and I saw the sunshine and the palm trees and all these white people. And I thought, yeah, I can do this, because I had come from that before. And, you know, and California is very kickback. It's very kickback. It's it was at this point, it was very multicultural. You know, my father lived in Lompoc. And, and I think from the moment I stepped foot in the Lompoc was the moment that my addiction and my, it blossomed. You know, that's what I did. You know, and I became this little wannabe thug. Well, by this time I was a thug, but that's what I became. And I remember I remember all of a sudden I was shooting heroin in the carports across the street from the high school. Who the fuck does that? But that's where I landed. I mean, I just kind of just went right in there. And you know, I started selling drugs. That's what I did. You know, that was a profession that I continued with all the way up till I got clean this last time. And I'll share a little bit about that. I'm not proud of it, but so that's what I did. And started dating the hottest girl in high school, of course, because, you know, I'm still working the women thing. And got her pregnant. And had a shotgun wedding that I don't remember because I got so drunk the day before. I have no memory of it. And next thing I know, I was off to boot camp for the United States Army. And that was a nightmare. And the reason why it was a nightmare, because you can drink in the Army. And I am a drinker. I'm one of those kind of drinkers that when you sit down and drink with me, you know something's going to pop off because Leonard's drinking. And I just got into one physical altercation after another, after another, after another. And, you know, we were stationed in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and I had brought my wonderful wife with me and our first kid, and it was more than 6 months I had to put on a plane and send her back home because I didn't know you know, for fear of her safety, for my life, because I was just into this whole gang thing. So I grew up in an era where the gangs had just started really beginning to form here. You know, for those of you that are younger, you probably, you know, watch movies like, what was that movie just came out? From Compton, the Straight Outta Compton. So you guys probably know it like that. I knew it as reality. And so I got kicked out of the military. I came back here, and all of a sudden, it was Crips, cocaine, and cash. And I very quickly acclimated to that. And, you know, I just remember one day, all of a sudden, it felt like a C-140 flew over Lompoc and opened it up and just dropped out cocaine. It just flew out of the sky. And, yeah, it was a very traumatic time. I thought it was fun at that point, but it was very traumatic. And next thing I knew, I was slamming cocaine and wearing a blue rag out of my pocket. And anybody who didn't walk like me, talk like me, or do what I did, they were open game, you know. And it was like a blur. It just happened like a blur, you know. All of a sudden, I was this guy. And then crack cocaine came out, and I started selling it. And I was the guy that would literally go around and knock on people's doors and say, "Hey, man, what's your name? Hey, Billy, what's up? Hey, man, try this." You know, and I did that. And I went, and I'm not proud of that, because as a result of that, there's people sitting in these rooms right now whose childhoods were horrific because their parents were smoking crack that I sold to them. You know, I know people that, you know, clients that I have today, and I don't really tell them about it, but I have clients today that I know that part of their problem was that they never slept in the bed, they never ate at the kitchen table, they probably never had a real life because their parents were smoking crack that I sold to them. You know, so part of my I'm sorry is that, you know what, I'm sorry that I did that, you know, because today I can see the devastation that it did to my community, but not just my community, but to our society as a whole. It was a horrific time for us. So I'm trying to say as much of my story as I can, so because I know there's people that can relate. So I did that for a while, and I got really good at it, very good at it. And I got organized, and I made lots of money, and I spent lots of money. And I became what you call ghetto fabulous. And I had this really cool reputation, and people loved me, and a lot of people hated me. But I felt like I had a home, and I had this thing, and this was my world. I mean, if you've ever been to Lompoc, you know, Lompoc is only this big, you know, and it's a hole. It's literally like this hole, but that became my world. That became my kingdom, and I was very invested in that. But I got to tell you, the other side of this quote-unquote gangster life is called state prison. It just kind of goes with the territory, you know, and I started finding myself at war with law enforcement. You know, and I was one of the guys that if they saw me walking down the street, they would pull me over, and they would make me get on the ground, and they would pat me down, and 9 times out of 10, they would take me to jail just for walking down the street. That became kind of the game that we played, and they all knew me, and I knew them, and we played this game of catch Leonard before, you know, he does something really bad to somebody, and my game was let me do as much shit out of here before you catch me, and I did that for quite a while, and that graduated to let me teach other people how to go out there and do that. And you know that I'm the one that's teaching them. So it kind of leveled up. And that made it even more, me more invested in it. You know, this made even me more invested in it. And I didn't know that at the time. But in the middle of all of that, I would do a lot of crazy shit. Just a lot of unthinkable crazy shit. And I remember before I went into the military, my dad had sent me to a psychiatrist. He thought I was crazy. I wasn't crazy. I was on drugs, but, you know. And this person said, why don't you go to AA? And the reason why they sent me to AA is because there really wasn't any NA at that time. So they sent me to AA, and I think they called it the Freedom Group. And I walked in the Freedom Group, and those people put one look at me, and they go, you know what? You need to go to AA. You know? We've got this guy. His name's Jack B. Go talk to him. And so I went and talked to, you know, saw this guy, his name was Jack, and he was my first sponsor, and I started going to meetings in Lompoc there was like two meetings in period. And what I found is that when I went to meetings, and so I'm going to share this for you relapsers, what I found about the 12-step programs that did for me is that I could go to a meeting of 12-step meeting, and if I sat in that chair and I talk like you talk, and I walk like you walk, and I showed up consistently, guess what? I wouldn't use drugs. And if I didn't use drugs, I wouldn't go to jail. And if I didn't go to jail, my life would get better. And if my life got better, then I would begin to get enough money and healthy enough in my pocket so that I could go out and do what? Sell some more drugs. And that became my new addiction. Probably for my first 10 years around here, I would get my ass beat up, I would go to jail, I'd go to prison, I'd get out, I'd go to AA 12-step meetings, I would sit around and do what you said do until I got it together enough to where I could get back out there into that street and into those gangs, into that game that I was so heavily invested in that I couldn't see any way out of it. Now, for a lot of you, you may not have that problem, but for those that you do, I got to tell you, it's probably the one thing that would have killed me out of everything. Not the drugs, not the gangs, but it was that identification with that lifestyle. I could not get past it. And I did that for quite a few years. And so anyway, on one trip to prison, my first trip to prison, so I'm from Lompoc. I'm not L.A., I'm not no Crip, I'm not no Blood, but I'm a wannabe Crip and I'm a wannabe Blood because L.A. is from L.A. As a matter of fact, I helped start the Crips in Lompoc, if you want, whatever you want to call that. But anyway, it's one thing to be doing that shit in Lompoc, it's another thing to be doing in state prison. So, I'm a little bit smarter than the average bear, you know what I mean? I'm halfway intelligent. So anyway, you know, I'm in the prison, and I get to prison, I get off this bus, and I look, and there's a whole sea of all these black people that are wearing blue. And then there's all these Mexicans wearing blue. And then there's all these Mexicans over here wearing red. And then there's little bit of black people over here wearing red. And I'm thinking, what the fuck should I do here? And one thing I want to acknowledge is I want to acknowledge my ancestors and the my spiritual guys that are here right now, that are here for you right now, because I know they're here, because there's no way for me to have navigated any of this if it had not been for them. And some of them are walking, breathing human beings, but then there's those that are unseen, and those are the ones that really, that I try to tap into today. And in that moment, I'm standing there, and I see this guy walking across the yard with a fucking book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go, that's where I'm going to go. And by the grace of God, I was able to get involved with one of the first in-house groups of Alcoholics Anonymous in Department of Corrections. It was in Tehachapi. It was called the Roadrunners. And it was a group of a bunch of lifers. Most of them were lifers. And they had been people that had been sentenced to life, and they had come down in points to the point where they could go to a lower level yard, and that's what these guys did. And so I hung out with those guys for the 18 months that I was there. That's what I did. I stayed out of trouble. I mean, I had a few altercations, but I stayed out of trouble. And while I was in there, you know, I got indoctrination into Alcoholics Anonymous. It started to become a way of life for me. If you're new and you're struggling with this program, the reason why you're struggling with it is because you're not treating it as a way of life. I had to realize that I could not use Alcoholics Anonymous to fix my life. I had to give my life to Alcoholics Anonymous and let it fix it. And I couldn't get that. And some days I still can't get it, but, you know, I'm not drinking, so it's all right. And so those guys, one thing they told me is they called me Young Blood. And they said, look, Young Blood, I ain't never getting out here, but I want you to go out there and live for me and don't come back. And that stuck with me because, you know, I mean, prison is just a horrific place in a lot of ways, especially when you don't have a chance to come back home. But it also does something, is it brings you face to face with reality. There's something that happens to a man when he's told that he's never going to see the streets again. It humbles him in a way that I need to be humbled on a regular basis, because that's what works for me, is humility. And so while I was there, I wrote a four-step. I didn't write a four-step. I wrote an autobiography. And so finally they decided to let me out of there. And it was ironic because it was like the week of Christmas. And I don't remember what year. It was a long time ago, a long fucking time ago. And they paroled me to a halfway house. So I went to this halfway house in Olive Vista, Santa Barbara. So I'm like, yes, Santa Barbara, yeah. And and one of those angels, man, I don't know what happened, but one of those angels was there again. And all of a sudden, they were like, here's Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's this dude who would come around this dude, he baffled me. He baffled me. Here's this guy, this white guy, who's the most humble, loving, caring, gentle man I've ever seen in my life. And he's riding around giving us rides to meetings. Didn't know me from Adam. He didn't know me from anybody. And he would come by and say, anybody want to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'm like, fuck it, I'll go. And so he would take us to meetings. He'd go around and pick people up and take us to meetings. And I ended up asking that man to be my sponsor, you know, because I had this fourth step I had to get rid of, you know. And so I remember he took me to went to the beach, and I read it to him. It probably took 2 days to read it. I mean, it was a fucking book, all right? And went to the beach, and he took it, and he said, he took it, and he lit it on fire, and he said, you know, all that's done. And he told me to look at the spoke, and he told me the story about the phoenix. You know, some real corny shit. You know what I'm saying? Was, but you know what? It was a beautiful thing. I had no idea what was really happening to me at that point, but I was, the process was beginning. And I hung around for a little while longer, and, you know, I got healthy, and, you know, the street started calling me again. I saw a couple of my homies, and they're there, and next thing I know, I was back out there again. And I did that for quite a while. But I kept going back to the program. The most powerful words in this fellowship are up on that wall right there. Keep coming back, no matter what. Keep coming back. For those of you who know me that are in and out, in and out, in and out, I need you to understand, I want you to hear something very clearly. I was exactly like you for a long time. You're okay. You're right where you're supposed to be. Because I came in and out of here and in and out of here and in and out of here, and I get to stand here before you today because I kept coming in and out of here. One of my exploits, I got Flower Festival. Our Flower Festival is always horrific. I've never made it to a Flower Festival in the whole time I've been a law firm. This particular Flower Festival, I'm in there and I come to one more time. And, you know, it was always the same. I would come to and I would think, oh, fuck, where's that pink piece of paper? And I'd get that pink piece of paper and I'd be like, what charges am I having? Because I didn't know my charges. When I always give you a pink piece of paper, when you're black, I just kind of throw you in there. And so luckily it wasn't too bad. And while I'm in there, all of a sudden, I wake up and I come to and there's someone sitting next to me and he's bawling, he's crying, sobbing. And it's a friend of mine. And I go, man, what's wrong, man? He goes, dude, I fucked up. I'm like, what's up? He says, man, I killed our homie. I said, what? He goes, yeah, we were drunk, and I don't know what the story was, but the end result is he had run over one of my little homies while he was drunk and killed him. And it was at that moment that I had that moment of clarity that could be me. And there was a book of Alcoholics Anonymous in there, and there was a Bible, and I thought, what the fuck? I'm fucked, you know? Neither one of these are working for me. And I remember grabbing that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember thinking that maybe, just maybe, maybe this thing might work for me. If I really give it a try, it might work for me. Because you know what? You know, I had been in these rooms, and I was walking the walk and talking the talk, but I wasn't convinced that this thing worked for me. You know, I knew that it would work as long as I could stay here, but I was missing something, and I didn't know what it was that I was missing. I just knew that I could only stay here for so long. And, you know, quite honestly, the people, by this time, the people in NA and Lompoc were getting tired of me, you know. You know, because I was one of them addicts, and I'm not proud of this, but I was one of those alcoholics and addicts. I would come to meetings. I would go to meetings, and I would, you know, snake the finest women in the meetings and run, you know. It was a social club for me. And you know, and that would have been okay had I stayed clean, you know, but it didn't. You know, and I met my second wife in here, and my stepson's in here right now, and you know, and today I'm grateful for that. But that's why I met her at Narcotics Anonymous. And you know, we played house for a while, and it turned into hell, you know. And I got out, but it was one of those exploits that I did back and forth. You know, and I have some beautiful kids because of that. I'm not going to get too much into my domestic part of it because that's not important. But, you know, this is where I learn how to live life, and this is where I learn how to make a lot of mistakes. You know, so if you're in here and you're making mistakes and you're screwing up, it's okay. This is what we do here. This is how we get here. So I had that moment of clarity, and I was like, okay, I'm going to really give this thing a try. And I got out and I started going to meetings and working the steps and doing all this other stuff. And of course, I got these kids. So I'm thinking, and I think I got like this, I got some, maybe 5-6 years, and she relapses. Now, I got to tell you, I got this thing, it's called ego.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there's no way I'm letting this bitch get away with that one. You really think I'm going to sit here and stay clean and watch you go get loaded? Uh-uh. So guess what I do? I go get loaded with her. And that kept me out there for quite a few years. And it took me a long time to get back. Here's something that I know about relapse. Relapse is something that happens, right? But coming back from a relapse is not something that just happens. It's a process. And it's going to take time. And if you don't stay here and keep your ass, and I keep my ass in this chair and following these steps, that relapse is going to turn into another and another, and I may never make it back. Just because I can stop after relapse does not mean I'm okay. You know? And so that's what my life was like for those last couple of years because of that one particular relapse. And so I was able to put it together, you know. But the one thing that I kept doing is I kept thinking that I could live those two lives. I kept thinking that I could live that lifestyle of a half-ass gangster, player, drug dealer. You know, I was still always doing things half-ass. You know, I'm not proud to say this, but you know, I sold drugs. I did everything in recovery that I did when I was outside of recovery. Everything. Some of it even better. And I'm not proud of that, but that's what I did. And so the last time I was doing pretty good and I had, you know, a really good job and I was making a lot of money and decided that we were going to move to Arizona and bought a house and did all this good shit. And and in the middle of that, it was Christmas break. It was Christmas holidays. And, I literally destroyed my first marriage and my kids. And that was a thing that I always carried with me because I remember my kids... My first two kids telling me, Dad, you know what? Fuck you. We don't even know you. They said, you know what? We know more about you from the streets than we know about you. And that hurt. That really hurt. Because this was those kids that I had. Remember when I was way back in the military and I was going to fix in that family that I lost? And that really hurt, and I never really got over that. Another part of that was that my son had been shot by the police. So that relationship was completely just devastated. And so I swore that was not going to happen with, you know, my next set of kids. Yeah, my next set. We're not going to do the domestic tonight, all right? So I decided that I was going to go see all my kids for Christmas. Now, about this time, they're spread out. And so I jump on a bus because I got my truck impounded. I mean, I had relapsed before that, but I'm determined to do this. So I jump on a bus, go all the way up to Oregon, have the Christmas of hell. It was so bad that Christmas Eve, I was like, Christmas Day Eve, I was like, take me to the fucking bus station, just drop me off. I'm out of here. And and I came back to Santa Barbara with my other baby's mom, and I spent that, whatever the week between Christmas and New Year's is, and that was hell. And so that night, Christmas Eve, taking off, and someone comes to me and they come to hand me a Bottles and James, and I took that Bottles and James, and I looked at it, and I thought, you know what? If I put this to my lips, I have no idea where I'm going to end up. And I gave it back to them, and I started walking. And I walked all the way to East Beach, and I watched the sun come up, the sunrise, on that New Year's Day, and I said, God, please help me. Please don't. Let this be it. Don't ever let me have to drink or use again. And I meant it from the very core of my being. Within the next 6 months, I lost everything. I went to prison. My dad died. Just everything that could possibly happen to me happened. And I was pissed off at God. And I know there's some people in here that are pissed off at God. And I get it. And now I can realize that, you know what, when I asked the Creator to help me, and I was willing, He helped me. It helped me. But part of helping me is moving all that shit that I had built up that wasn't supposed to be there in the first place. And I did not like that at all. And I ended up here in Santa Maria. And then I ended up in a riot in LA County Jail. And so it was just horrific. And I ended up paroling from LA County Jail. This is 8:15, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we got 20 minutes to get clean. Okay, we're getting clean now. And at this point, I am traumatized. And when I'm telling you traumatized, I am telling you I am like battle-worn. One of the things I want to share with you, you know, is that when you're living the lifestyle that I'm living, it's a war-type mentality. And so the tension is so high that it literally will make you sick. I mean, literally, I was physically ill. And so I paroled from L.A. County Jail. I don't know if I've ever been to L.A. County Jail, but if there's a hell on earth, that's it. And I paroled from there, so which means I had nothing. So they gave me some of their nasty-ass clothes I had to put on to parolers. I mean, I'm like, I'm at a low. I can't, couldn't get no lower. So I had to walk to the parole office in downtown L.A., beg them to give me a bus ticket to come here to Santa Maria to enroll into a halfway house that I, by the grace of God, another one of those angels had told me to do. And so when I got here, I remember I walked into that place. No, first I got here and I went to my parole office, this officer of the day, and I remember sitting down in front of him, across from him, and I just broke down in tears. I just started sobbing. You know, I was just devastated. But what I was at that point is I was willing. I was willing, you know. And he gave me an ID because I didn't have an ID. You know, a picture of my CDC picture and all this other shit. And then they brought me over here to this house. It was on the corner of Cook and Depot. I don't know if anybody's been here. It used to be sober living there.
I remember.
And so I walked in there, and there's a bunch of half of fucking Northwest is in there smoking shit. Now you got to remember, I just came out of a race war in L.A. County Jail. So, I mean, that in and of itself is like I'm traumatized. I'm thinking, okay, God, you really got some jokes going on here. And I'm like, Spencer, man, look, I'm just trying to turn my life around, and you know, I don't want no problems and blah 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 blah. And they're like, all right, cool, bro, we get it, you know. And they kept smoking their shit, but we had that understanding. And so I remember it was raining, and I walked from that place over to the Alano Club. I got to tell you something. I loved the Alano Club. It saved my life. And I walked in that room, and I sat down in that chair, and I raised my hand, and I said, you motherfuckers told me you would help me. Now fucking help me. And that's what I did. I sat in that motherfucking chair, man. I was at every noon meeting because I wasn't working. I was unemployable. And I remember I came here and, you know, I mean, I'm devastated. Devastated. So I come here to a meeting and I'm sitting down in a chair and in walks that same man who almost 20 years ago to the very day walks in. And I'm sitting on another four step. And I go to him and I said, hey, man, would you be my sponsor? And he said, sure, man, I'll be your sponsor. And he loved me because I was like a little baby. I was like a child, man. I didn't know how to do anything. I didn't know how to do life out here. And he loved me, and we did another four step. And we moved forward, and he gave me my first job, you know, because I was unemployable. And I started putting the pieces together very slowly. And what happened is, and he would tell me all the time, knowledge of God's will for you and the power to carry that out. And I would think, if this is God's fucking will for me, man, we're gonna have a fucking talk when I see him. You know, because this shit is not right, you know, this is not right, but I kept doing it. And there was a lot of obstacles, you know, and I got kicked out of that fucking house. I got kicked out of that house. And I remember thinking, fuck, here we go. If you're here right now and you have that black cloud over your head thinking, you know what, I know it's fucking happening. I know shit is going to fall apart because shit always falls apart because nothing ever works out. You're probably right. As long as you're working on your will. But if you're doing God's will, it's going to be okay.
That's right.
And so at that point, I didn't know that shit. I didn't believe it. But I knew that I didn't have any other choice. So what I did is I sat on my hands, and I did exactly what you told me to do. And I kid you not, Within 12 hours, I was in another house. And I had to stay really close. I had to stay really close. Because I got great ideas, and I'm really smart, you know what I mean? And I got skills, and I got great fucking character assets, you know what I'm saying? But none of them fucking work for me. They don't work for me. I have not been able to put together any long-term plan that has ever even come close to fruition, ever. So I learned that I just had to do what was in front of me to the best of my ability. And I got to tell you, it was not fancy. It was not pretty. It was not glorious. It wasn't none of that. And what did I end up doing? I ended up living in freaking sober livings for 4 years. I stayed in a sober living for my first 4 years of recovery. And I got to tell you something. That was probably the most miraculous, loving, growing, beneficial time in my life. You know, and I was able to help a lot of men, and they were able to help me. And we grew together. And we did things like live life on life's terms. Now, I gotta tell you something. I've done a lot of shit that I thought was courageous. Matter of fact, one of my favorite things to do, I'll share this real quick, is that I love to smoke sherm. I'm gonna tell you why I love to smoke sherm. Because see, I can sit here and think of all the stupid shit that I wanted to do that I didn't have the courage to do, and I smoke enough of that shit, and guess what I was doing? And motherfuckers would think I was King Kong, you know what I'm saying? And but none of that came close to the courage that it takes to wake up each day and do the next right thing because it's the right thing to do. Doesn't even come close. And what's even better that I found is to wake up the next day and do the next right thing and help another human being do the next right thing. And the reason why I love doing that is because they hate doing it twice as much as I do. But when they do it, they're twice as grateful as I am.
That's right.
And I have men that come to me all the time, and they're all, Leonard, thank you for blah, 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 blah. And I'm just like, man, I just told you to do the shit I didn't want to do. That's all I did, you know? They're like, I'm happy and shit. I'm like, yeah, I'm happy too, you know? Fuck it, take me to me. But it wasn't about me. It wasn't about me. It was about this process. It was about this fellowship. It was about those steps. And what those steps are is spiritual principles. You know, their direction. And one thing about direction is direction equals action. If I'm receiving direction, it's a set of actions. No one tells you, hey, you know what, can you tell me how to get to L.A.? I want you to sit down and think about it for 2 days. No! They tell you, get in your car, go left, go right, go, you know, and that's what these are. These are directions, and you have to take action on them if you want to get the results. And you don't have to do it because if you don't want to get the results, don't do it. You won't get the results. And the funny thing about people like me is that I usually don't take action until I get in enough pain. And I have learned that pain can be perspective. So one of the things that has helped me move forward, I'm going to share this part. So my favorite part in the whole book is, what's in the chapter 5 where it says, what's the point? Yeah, baby. It's to be willing to grow along spiritual lines. I got news for you. The way I live my life was always on one side or the other, and it was treacherous for me and everybody around me, and I knew it. I was a menace to society. I needed to be incarcerated, and I could not trust myself. I did not know how to stay in the lines. But somewhere along that process, I realized as long as I'm willing to crawl along spiritual lines, I'm going to be okay. And I've never felt like I was going to be okay, ever. I never felt like I was going to be okay. So when I started working those steps, you guys were teaching me these spiritual principles I knew nothing about. But I kept acting on them, and my life started to get better. And one of the funny things that I found out about this process here is it's not about the freaking outside. It's about the inside. I'm still chasing feel good. But I'm chasing the feel good that makes me feel good instead of me making myself feel good. And I didn't know that. I don't lie today because I don't feel good when I lie. I don't cheat today because I don't feel good when I cheat. I don't steal today because I don't feel good when I steal. I come here and share with you as honestly as I possibly can, because for me to do any less is for me to cheat me and to cheat you and to cheat the universe, and there's a price to pay for that. And if you're new, I just hope that you stay. Because if you think that what I'm saying here is so fucking great and so elegant, wait till you hear what you have to say. Because you got it in you. I don't have nothing special here. I have nothing unique about any of this process. The only thing that I might have that you don't have is I got a little bit more willingness than you. But you know why I got a little more willingness than you? Because I've been doing this shit a little bit longer. When you're new, I know your willingness is short and your belief is none. But what we need you to do is have faith and take action. If you have faith and take action, your life will transform. And I would love to be a part of that process. And even if you don't want to take faith and take action, just keep fucking coming back. I want to be part of that process too. I love to see people walking here all fucked up for the 57th time. You know? And for those of you that know me, you know that I'm one of those kind of people that if you know me, you know that I don't judge you because of your root out. I don't care what the fuck you do, you know. And the reason why I do that is because I come from that place. I'll tell you right now, it's still not even good for me to go to Lompoc. You know, because I was so treacherous in that fellowship. I did so much shit for so long, you know. But there's people there that love me. And I love them, because that's what this fellowship does. It gives me the capacity to love and the capacity to be loved. Yeah. You know, and this is a program of growth. And one thing about growth is it's fucking slow, man. It's so slow. And it's imperceptible. Imperceptible? What it means is I can't see it. But it happens. You know, and it happens consistently. I am so honored to stand here and watch these young ladies. And who else took a cake? Yes. Bobby, there you go. Because you know what? I got to be a part of that process. I got to be a part of that process. And I got to watch them grow and get better and turn into these wonderful, beautiful human beings that they can't even fucking see. That to me is what's funny. Because I know they still look in the mirror and they still see that worthless piece of shit. And I'm like, oh, you are so wrong. You know, because I still look in the mirror and see that worthless piece of shit. But then I come in here, you people love me and hug me and do all this other shit, and I go, wow, maybe they're right. Maybe they see something that I don't see. And that's what the beauty of this fellowship is. But if I don't show up, you can't love me. And I tell you, when I'm alone by myself, it gets dark and ugly really fast. Because I still have a very, very low opinion of myself. You know? And the sad part about it is when I start to get a high opinion of myself, I'm fucked. You know what I'm saying? It took me a long time to figure out that it wasn't my job to raise my self-esteem. It's my job to do the next right thing. And my self-esteem grows as a result of that. So I want to share a little bit about that spiritual path. So what's happened for me is that I've had that willingness to grow along spiritual lines. And it's taken me to some wonderful, just fantastic, marvelous places. I've been able to experience things in the spiritual realm that it's a whole other world that I didn't even know existed. And so I realized that this is what this game is all about. But that spirituality, it's yours. It's a relationship that you have for yourself. And it's something that's kind of, in the beginning, is difficult to get, because I always thought that I had to do something for this, whatever this thing was, for it. And all I had to really do was just let it. All I had to really do was let it. And if you're here today, you're okay. No matter what's going on in your life, no matter what happens in your past, no matter how bad you feel, how much guilt, remorse, or how many people are pissed off at you, or how many warrants you got, or, you know, or how many you lost your kids and, you know, burnt down your house. You may have taken another person's life. And I got to tell you that if you're in this room right now and you're sober, you're okay. And if you just stay right here with us one day at a time, that shit will get better. It is impossible for it to not get better. And all that matters is what we do from here forward. Mm-hmm. The worst path in the world. And you know, if you keep coming back, you'll hear people come up here with stories. You'll be like, what the fuck? You came back from that shit? But if what we do here forward is what makes a difference. So you have all the hope in the world. All the hope in the world. And I got to tell you something. Hope may not be shit, may not be much, unless you ain't got none. If you're sitting here right now, you ain't got no hope, let me give you some. Because the future is only a representation of what I do today. I keep thinking that my past is going to come beat my ass. My past can't touch me. It's done. It's what I do forward. All right. So one more time, I just want to tell each and every one of you that I love you. And I want to let you know that you may say, oh, man, how the fuck you going to love me? You don't know me. And I tell you, I may not know you, but I know the alcoholic in you. And that I can love. Thanks for letting me share.
And this is that sponsor.
Let's give Leonard another hand.